So do that, and let me know if you face any problem. Let's see. I told you that we will be recording these lectures, but I'm not sure that started to happen yet. So we'll find out. So in the meanwhile, pay attention in the class. Okay. All right, so any other questions before I begin? Okay, so okay, let's start where we left off. We were talking about large parallel machines. So there are three categories of machines that I that we discussed. We said multi-core machines on single desktops are becoming commonplace, and that's one class that's kind of one has to deal with, and it is becoming bigger and bigger. Maybe some of you will encounter that in real life much more than you would encounter the clusters. The second category is clusters are becoming ubiquitous. Small departments, etc., now have it. It's not considered a big resource anymore, and so as a result, lots and lots of places are installing clusters. And the third one was really large parallel machines that are national resources that are kept at centers and maybe in some cases allocated to researchers through National Science Foundation. Time on these machines is allocated. In some other cases, it's meant for mission, such as the NASA for doing its work, or for Department of Energy for doing its work. And so they might build computers that are just meant for themselves. These are the large machines. So we were talking last time about what are some of the examples of the large machines, and someone mentioned BlueJean at Livermore, and that performs at this unfathomable rate just a few years ago of half a petaflop, okay, 500 teraflop, and a teraflop is 1,000 gigaflop, and that's really a huge, huge performance level. Just a few years ago, maybe 6 years ago, there were workshops that I was attending where people were talking about petaflops, and petaflop just sounded like something something way out there. In fact, people didn't even know whether to call it a peta or penta, what's the right term, and because it was not much in use, you know, you wouldn't find peta anything being used if you go back, you know, 8, 7, 10 years ago. And so but the technology has moved on pretty quickly, and we can now build machines that are close to this petaflop. 500, 480 or something like that teraflops is the speed of the machine at BlueJean machine at Livermore, Lawrence Livermore National Lab, consists of about 200,000, something over 200,000 processors, processor cores. And these are relatively, so there is some design alternatives that we will see when we look at that. But BlueJean is one of the two machines. The IBM announced BlueJean maybe, again, right in response to another machine. Did I mention Earth Simulator last time? Okay, so what happened is something like 5 years ago, I should get the date right here, but something like 4 or 5 years ago, we had this computer called Earth Simulator that Japan announced, and it was performing at the rate, yes? Ooh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you for pointing that out. House computer, that's what it should be. Okay, there you go. So the Earth Simulator, so I was summarizing these slides here. Multi-core, clusters, and humongous parallel machines. So 5 years ago, we were talking about the Japanese announced the Earth simulator. It was 35 to 40 teraflops. And that was, until then, you know, you would get a little bit of improvement every year compared to the previous computer. But this was 3 or 4 times faster than the best computer at that time, which was also a Department of Energy computer in the US. And compared with that, this was a substantial improvement. And it came as a big surprise. It shouldn't have been a surprise, because those of us who were in the field and were talking to the Japanese, they were giving talks everywhere. We visited, people visited them. It's so pretty open that they had a plan to build this machine for over 5 years, right? So this plan for this machine existed. Everything was known, well, not everything, but the performance targets, et cetera, were not a big surprise. If anything, that there was a surprise that the Japanese would be able to actually build and install this machine, and that came as a big shock. People, of course, who are not paying attention, it came as a big shock and said, how can the US lose its technology edge in the world like that? You can't be second place, right? America is the top place as far as technology is concerned, and its strategic advantage for computers was recognized. It shouldn't be second. So in some sense, it was like somewhat like a Sputnik-like shock. Admittedly, Japan is not the same as Soviet Union was. It is not a rival in that sense, or enemy even, certainly not. But some aspects of being relegated to the second place, being shocking, actually were similar. And what it did, and some of you, most all of you are too young to remember this, but you might have read in history that Sputnik, the Russians first being forced to space by sending this satellite Sputnik in space, actually spurred on the American technology, spurred on a technology race, and John F. Kennedy then announced that we will put a man on moon by the end of the decade. And indeed, in 1969, Apollo landed on moon. And so that required a huge amount of investment in technology. It spurred on interest among high school kids to go to science and engineering as important fields, and so on. Well, that second part of it, I'm not sure is happening here yet. But the first part, the government putting a lot of resources into supercomputing, happened as a result of the Earth simulator. And so, so we'll see in a minute what the history was like. But now we have BlueJeans with 200,000 processors. There is another one that we routinely use in my lab. That's about 40,000 processors at IBM. And of course, the Livermore machine is so-called. It is not available for public use. Let's just put it that way. It's behind the fence. It's not something that you can directly use. Outsiders. But there's going to be petascale machines right in this year, 2008. Even as we, maybe before this class ends, we will have the first petaflop machine installed somewhere. And I don't know which one of them will go first. Probably it won't happen by May. But during 2008, both Oak Ridge and Argonne are slated to come up with a petascale machine. The other machine is the Cray. There are a couple of important players, IBM with his BlueJeans, and Cray with his XT3, XT4 machine. And we'll learn a little bit about the machines later on in the course in terms of the details. But one distinction right now one should make is what kind of processors to use, right? If you use a powerful processor on your desktop, that's a couple of hundred watts per processor, and you put a large number of them together, you get one kind of machine, and that's the Cray XT3, XT4. They use Opteron processors and so on, so more traditional processors, high power processors, and you get one kind of machine. That machine is very powerful, uses only fewer nodes than, say, something like BlueJeans would use, but consumes a lot of power and needs a lot, and basically consumes a lot of power. Now, the alternative is to something like what IBM did with this BlueJeans design. It's called BlueJeans, blue, of course, because it's IBM, and Gene because it was originally meant for solving problems in biology, and so, you know, genetics, and so gene. And so this BlueJean design was a low power processor. They took their embedded processor, something called PowerPC 440, and then refurbished it, remodeled it a little bit at the chip level to make a low power two core chip. And that's what they used in the BlueJean. As a result, it's a machine for every floating point operation. For a fixed amount of computation, it consumes a less electricity than something like a Cray XT3 would, okay, or something like your desktop would. So per amount of computation, the amount of electricity, the wattage required is smaller. That's the design divergence there between those two designs. So here is a picture of what performance looked like over the years. Interesting thing, I don't have a laser pointer, nor should I use one if it has to make sense in the recording. This middle curve is the top machine, right? So you can see in 2007, and this is from top500.org, that's the website. Top 500 is sort of like a competition. They have a standard benchmark, a particular program that everyone has to run to get a performance number. And that performance number, like I said, the peak performance is the performance that the manufacturer guarantees the machine won't exceed. But Linpack, a particular benchmark used here, is the benchmark which is pretty close to that peak performance, usually achieves, you know, 80% of the peak and so on. It's that benchmark that people have to run and compete if they want to compete in the top 500 list. And so the top 500 list is updated every 6 months, roughly, once at supercomputing and once during another conference in the summer. Supercomputing conference happens in November. So this November 2007, that was updated. I guess that's 2007. So that was the last update. And that all that happened there was the BlueJean, and this middle curve is the top machine. I'll tell you what the other curves are in a second. So the top machine, they just added a few more processors to increase its performance a little bit. But notice that this curve is pretty, what's the word for it? Steppy. There are steps here, right? This is a flat region, this is another flat region, then you step between them. This is a flat region, then you step between them. This corresponds to the previous machine, this before at DOE, this corresponds to the Earth simulator. So there was a big jump, and now we can tell what year it was, 2001-2. In 2002 or so, 2002, yes, there was a big jump here, and so that went from, what is it now, something like 7 or 8 teraflops to more than 30 teraflops here. And then that stayed for a while. No one could do any better than that for years. 1, 2, 3 years, 2.5 years, nothing. Then 3 years later comes this early version of BlueJean, I think. That's what that was. And then the full-fledged BlueJean finally managed to do better than stayed here, became a champion, and stayed at the same level for, again, 2 more years. So this happens in spurts. New machines don't get designed that quickly, but still 2 years is a remarkable time, and it has stayed on here. And I can easily say that we will be crossing that 1 petaflop mark this year, right? What are the other two curves? The other two curves are, the green one is a summation of all the power of the top 500 machines. And again, starting from 1993 to 2007, you can see that's a pretty smooth increase in that curve. And the bottom curve is, what is the entry point, the 500th machine in the world? What is its power? What does it take to get in the top 500? And notice that in 93, it was less than a gigaflop, okay? So that's that. I don't know what that number is, maybe a few hundred megaflops. Your computer today, the desktop today, is about, you know, 5 times faster than that, more, probably 10 times faster than that entry point there. Today, though, the entry point into that list is about six teraflops, okay? And so that also is another smooth increase, which allows you to predict what will happen to this curve over the next few years. Predict only as in a trend, okay? So, okay, any questions about this? Any curiosity questions about what the what these data points are and so on? So this machine had, Earth Simulator. I didn't say what the Earth Simulator had. Earth Simulator took the other extreme than the BlueJeans, which is very powerful processors. It had only 4,000 processors, but very powerful processors with vector units and so on. We don't have to know what that is right now, but it took that approach. And these machines now, the BlueJeans then has taken the low power approach, and it's likely that future machines would have to consider power in some fashion. You know, can't have 10 megawatts of power for every supercomputer all the time. You have to stop at some point and start worrying about power. If you project this in future, you can see that that predicts that the entry point will cross a petaflop, entry point in the top 500 list, well, by 2016 or something like that. Okay, that's not too far. You will be in the prime or early stages of your career when the top 500 entry point will be over a petaflop. And pause for a second and think about what a petaflop is. Okay, petaflop is 10 to the power 15 floating point operations per second. 10 to the power 15. That number sitting there, 15, doesn't give you the idea of what that is. So you need something else to compare. My pet comparison is human brain. Okay, so you know, you heard about there are about 100 billion neurons in brain. They fire at the rate of maybe 10 milliseconds. If you just count that, how much does that give you? 100 million, 10. Milliseconds gives you about 100 hertz, right? 100 times per second they would fire. So 100 billion multiplied by 100 is 10 trillion. Okay, 10 teraflops. If you equate a firing of a neuron with a floating point operation, that's just 10 teraflops. But in fact, these neurons connect to each other at synapses. And if you count each synapse connection as an operation, so you multiply it by another 10,000 or something like that, what do you get? 10 teraflop multiplied by 10,000, you would get 100 petaflops. But you know, maybe each synapse connecting everywhere doesn't have to count. Not all neurons are doing something useful. Petaflop is corresponds to your to the power of the brain in terms of some kind of a raw equation. Okay, but and so it's a huge amount of compute power. Again, think about your desktop. A gigaflop, maybe 10 gigaflops. Compared with one petaflop is a million times faster. A million times faster than your desktop is what you're talking about. And what can you do with that kind of power? That's part of the thing that we'll return back to. Some of the interesting points about this top 500 list. Okay, let's look at the, I don't know if you can see it in the back, can you? Can you read it a bit, okay? So I will read out to you from here anyway some interesting facts here. If you look at the top machine that has 212 almost 213,000 processors, each node has two processors in it, and these two numbers, and you should go to top500.org just to look at it, R max and R peak. R peak is the number of floating point operations that machine can perform if you just let it do nothing but silly floating point operations, right? If you make it do some real program, you know, in a real program, you have to wait for memory and things like that, and so things slow down a bit, and so that particular real program, the Linpack benchmark, it gives you 478 teraflops, okay? And so this is, so that's the unit here. Unit is gigaflops, and so peak is already more than half a petaflop. The second, so if you look at, that's the BlueJeans machine. The second is a BlueJeans machine. Now, interesting thing is the third and fourth are Intel processors, okay? And so the one of them is built by SGI, the other one built by HP. What's also interesting about the number four machine is it's the first time that there is a machine in India. The Indian Chinese machines had made it into the top couple hundred, I forget, top 500 for sure. Indian machine was pretty rare in any top 100, and now that's at almost third or fourth position, because third and fourth are very close here, right? And so this is another example. What's happening is that it's not, I mean, for one thing, it's an example of emergence of the whole world rising up, especially India and China rising up in economic status. For another, it says that the technology is commodity. Just take Intel processors, put InfiniBand cluster, they actually have some additional interconnection topology innovations in that machine. This particular machine happens to be in my hometown where I grew up, so in India. So it's of interest to me. I visited them. I didn't go to the machine room. The machine rooms are boring. Although this would have been interesting to, I didn't have time. So that's also another interesting thing to me, that it's from my hometown. But the point is, all over the place, it's in India now, right? The number four machine. If you look at, and that's actually, there is a big gap between the top machine and the second machine, 478 to 167, yes. Number four is what? With the location you're asking? Tata is the name of the company. You heard about the new car that they put out, but Tata is like a GE. It's a conglomerate. It has a large number of companies. Tata Consulting Services does the software business, and yes, in fact, the original thing is they built locomotives, the train engines, and then on they have steel and. Those of you who drink tea, Tata, there is a tea, Tetley is Tata and so on. It's a big conglomerate. That's why it's like G. It's still a useful question to, it's still a curiosity. I wondered, why would Tata want a big, large computer? And in fact, it's not clear. It's just like why IBM decided to announce BlueJean in 2001. We're speculating. There's no business really, at least at that time, that was visible for BlueJean. And they said, we'll build machine. IBM said, we'll build this machine. It will cost us $100 million, and its purpose will be to do simulation of biomolecules, a 1 millisecond in the life of a molecule to figure out protein folding, okay? And the speculation at that time was a Super Bowl ad costs, what, $1 million for 30 seconds or something like that. This kind of machine brings publicity that's probably worth that many Super Bowl ads. So it's not clear that there is any business rationale here. I'm being a little bit cynical here, but I talk to those people and see what they're doing. They're doing animations as one of their initial things, apparently. That is to say, you know, when Pixar produces a movie, it takes a huge amount of compute power to produce those Shrek frames of animated movies, that kind of stuff. There is some Boeing fluid. There's some talk of fluid dynamics work for Boeing and so on, and I have a feeling that they're yet to figure out exactly what to do with the machine. But so is a lot of people. It's a trophy to some extent, right? And this is I'm being recorded here, so I don't know. My friends will watch this and say something about it. But I think that's to some extent that's how technology progresses here. Is that you got to go far ahead and plant a flag and then figure out what to do with it. A whole lot of technology happens that way, right? Even PCs. What the heck? Why do you need a much more powerful PC for? Well, you build it, and then someone makes a speech recognition system that now functions much better on the faster PC. So some of it is that, and some of it is the applications will come. The application and we'll talk about what applications there are. They're not going to make all their applications for internal use. They're going to sell the compute cycles to outsiders as well. And this number three system is another interesting one. It's an academic system in University of New Mexico that, just for research then, is putting together a machine that's a similar capacity, 126 teraflops, 118 teraflops there. And if you look at number, so let's just quickly look at what kinds of machine. Xeon, that's Intel machine, Opteron. But that's Opteron based on Cray. So that's Cray is a more of a proprietary machine, a machine designed specially for parallel processing. Otherwise, the Xeon and InfiniBand are commodity clusters, right? So that's a Xeon InfiniBand. That's a Xeon InfiniBand. That's a Xeon, but built together with SGI, a proprietary network. Jaguar. At Oak Ridge, this is another machine that we use in my group, and that's a Cray XT4 or XT3. XT4 is just the next version that uses the Opteron processors and Cray's proprietary network. BlueJean, BGW, that's BlueJean again. That's the 40,000 processor machine that I mentioned earlier, and so on. So you can see that there's this mix of low power and high power machines, basically BlueJean or Cray, and a smattering of few clusters that have risen to the top level. If you look at the Earth Simulator, Earth simulator is now at number 30. So something that was at the top of the list here, just at this point, 2004, it was at the top of the list. Not only did something overtake it and BlueJean became much better, Earth simulator is now number 30 in the list. Okay, and if you look at the bottom four here, what kinds of machines are those? Those are clusters, InfiniBand cluster there, gigabit Ethernet based cluster, which is surprising that they could get that kind of a performance on that. You can notice that there is a 10 teraflop, 9,999, 10 teraflop peak, but they got only about 60% of that, and part of the reason must be the fact that they have a somewhat slower network. Gigabit Ethernet is a slower network, InfiniBand is a faster network, proprietary network such as what IBM uses in BlueJean or Cray uses in their machine are even faster and more expensive. Again, Gigabit Ethernet here and Gigabit Ethernet there and so on. So let's see if my hypothesis holds. Yes, 7,400 peak, but 6,000 almost actual performance on the benchmark because of the faster network here. That's my guess. All right, so that's what it takes to enter this list. In other words, we have a preponderance of very large machines now. What for? What are these computers good for? Why people want, we touched upon that a little bit in answer to your question. Some of it is just as a trophy machine, right? We can now have a world's top four machine or top machine. Yes, but hopefully there is something better rationale than that. What are these machines good for? So I want you to tell me some of the applications. Some of you came here with from application areas. Maybe you can bring up your application at this point and tell others. But your view of what would you do with a petaflop computer? What could one do with a petaflop computer? Yes. Say that again. Simulate a whole airplane as opposed to its wing in flight. I suppose there are other ways of simulating. Planes are now built in a digitized fashion. That is, the entire plane is designed, all its parts and how they fit and so on. That's digitized. That wouldn't require a petaflop. But you want to simulate a plane in flight, what the aerodynamics around it is and so on. And okay, so that would be one example. Don't know for sure that requires a petaflop or not. We'll come back to that question in a minute. But that's a good example, something that needs a lot of compute power. Yes. Yes. Say that again. What supernova? Core collapse of a supernova, right? So astronomical phenomena such as that are basically what kind of computation is involved in that? Right, and the physics that's happening is also pretty complicated, right? You have to understand how this gravitational collapse works and so on. So a whole bunch of things happening in three-dimensional structure in a supernova. Okay, anything else? Yes. Molecular dynamics with billion atoms. What would you do that for? Material science, right? So studying material properties at molecular level, materials are really the next frontier, one of the next frontiers in science where humongous advances are happening, and you can construct new materials and study their properties without actually building the material you want to be able to experiment with. What could happen if we put such and such material together, and what would its properties be? And you can actually study those by multi-billion atom crystal structures and figuring out what happens with them. Any other kind of molecular dynamics anyone knows? Yes. Quantum computing simulation, yes. And what kind of, what would you do with that? So there's material properties of for materials that are kind of large materials like an airplane wing or something like that. But you also want to study material properties of properties of materials at other levels, like electrical properties of materials or semiconductor properties of material and so on. So all kinds of behavior of the material under different conditions, some of that involves quantum phenomena. You have to get the quantum phenomena, right, for you to understand the behavior of this material, and you can do that by simulating not just at the atom level, but at level below that. And there are all kinds of levels there. One can go to, you can go into electronic states and you know, and study the behavior at that level. One can go at the level of particles and you know, study behavior, matter at that level, and so on, and be able to come up with our basic understanding of physics and connect it to some macroscopic phenomena that we can observe. And if we can derive that, if we can derive that from basic principles, then we have validated our understanding of physics and the basic laws. This is actually behind a whole bunch of other this idea is behind a whole bunch of other computational simulations as well. There is a story which I'm not sure is true, and I don't know if I'm ascribing it right, but I think it was Schrödinger who said, no, hold on, who would it have been? But let me give you the quote. The quote was that all the physics is done now, all that remains is computation. I just have, by that he obviously meant calculation, right, in those days, well, a little computation maybe. But it turned out the computation is much too tough. The basic physics may be correct, captures all the phenomena, but to actually figure out a particular phenomena, what should be the specific heat of this particular material, what should be the temperature at which such and such superconductivity will happen in this material, to predict those things accurately requires computation that's just humongous. And so it's not just computation. And so, for one thing, you need mathematical tricks to reduce that computation, and for another thing, you need a huge amount of computation power to do whatever remains to be done just by calculation. And so, then what you get by doing that is say, hey, is my theory right? Are the constants correct? That's behind computational astronomy as well, computational cosmology, where you're trying to figure out how, based on our understanding of laws of physics, can we predict how the universe evolved, starting from some point around Big Bang, right? And we know the conditions from that based on the microwave radiation, and now we have some theories about what are the physical laws and what's the proportion of dark matter and dark energy and stuff like that. Can we figure out, can we get our computer model to evolve to something resembling today's structures of galaxies and, you know, the filaments and so on that we see in the, when we observe the universe. If we do, then our understanding of the physics is correct. If we don't, we need to tinker with our basic understanding of physics. Yes, you had something else. Yes, that's in a collaboration, my collaboration with biophysics, Klaus Schulten's group. And in fact, what does that brought? So that simulated an entire life form, as it were. Although entire life form doing pretty much nothing for a tiny fraction of its life, but still, that was a big milestone. But fundamentally, what we're after, and that was the Blue Gene Project, for example, is remember all our biological systems, our biology, all the plant and animal kingdom, and so on, actually function. Because of the proteins, right? The proteins are molecules that take particular shape and have particular electrostatic landscape around them. There are cell membranes, proteins, DNA molecules, and so on, and that defines the machinery of life. To understand the machinery of life at the level of molecules, so happens that in most cases you don't need to invoke quantum mechanics for that, okay? And so classical understanding, classical simulation at the atomic level, though, and you want to simulate an entire biological system, a cell membrane through which allows water to pass through, but doesn't allow, for example, an oxygen ion to pass through. How can that be, right? An oxygen ion is smaller than water, right? Water has one oxygen in there. And so how does that happen? Well, you do a molecular level simulation of this aquaporin molecule, total maybe 300,000 320,000 atom simulation, of which consists of the cell membrane, which consists of the molecule that strides across, sits across the cell membrane, the aquaporin molecule, the protein, and then the water all around and above and below, and see what happens to the water molecules. Just see it, right? If your understanding of the physical laws is sound, then you should be able to see the behavior of the atoms, and that should correspond to what happens in real life. atomistic simulation of biological phenomena is another place where we want to use these computers for. And it turns out it's challenging, and we'll probably pick examples from that, because the particular program that's now the world's best is actually comes from our group, from this collaboration with Professor Shulten, and developed by my group in that collaboration. It's a program called NAMD. And so we'll probably pick examples from that as our case studies. But what is the challenge there? The challenge is that atoms have to be simulated at the level of the time step of a femtosecond. Why? Because if you look at a bond between two atoms, right? If you look at hydrogen and oxygen connected together, that oscillates, and the natural oscillation period is something like 10 femtosecond. Femtosecond, again, is 10 to the power minus 15 seconds. So microsecond, 1 millionth of a second, nanosecond is 1,000th of that, picosecond is 1,000th of that, and femtosecond is 1,000th of that. Okay? So 10 femtosecond is a period, so to capture that whole period, right, you have to do simulation at the level of a femtosecond, yet biological phenomena happen at the scale of milliseconds. We can't really get to milliseconds, but we'd like to get to a close to a microsecond, right? And so doing microsecond simulations when the time step is a femtosecond requires a billion time steps, and yet you have only a few hundred thousand atoms to work with. How can you simulate a few hundred thousand atoms, evolution of a system of few hundred thousand atoms on a 200,000 processor system, right, that we saw in the blue gene? That's some of the challenges that face us. But if we can do those challenges, then we'll be able to do better drug design, for handling diseases and so on, newer the so-called rational drug design, rather than just looking at various drug, looking at various compounds and see, does this help, does this help, does this help, does this help? That's the trial and error method of the past for drug design that's still used, and we'd like to get to a more rational drug design where we actually study the causality and figure out what molecule can we design that will interfere with this particular virus, this particular disease agent, and so on, right? Okay, any other examples? Okay, so there are several examples one can come up with. Weather prediction is, of course, one of the best. We'd like to know exactly what the weather is going to be like, and weather and climate prediction is another thing. Climate is long term, weather is short term, right? Weather prediction means what will the weather be tomorrow or next week. Climate prediction is what will happen in 100 years. And with all this talk of global warming and so on, the climate prediction is also a fairly important thing. Right now, weather prediction is stuck at few hundred processors. Maybe it has risen to 1,000 processors level, but it is pretty, most of the production weather models that are used typically use tens of processors, maybe hundreds of processors. And they, if they can use this 100,000 processor type of a machine and do much more accurate weather prediction of the entire globe, maybe feeding in the data from sensors continuously into it, we are at that point where we can imagine having more or less perfect weather prediction. Modulo, of course, you know, where the weather, where the cloud will burst and where the lightning will be, there are all these chaotic phenomena that make things not very predictable. And so you have to take that into account, but you can get closer and closer to good prediction. So other areas are things like operations research. If you design the best possible schedule for airlines, you might end up saving fuel that they waste, or the crew time that they waste otherwise. That kind of thing can save tens of millions of dollars and becomes possible with a relatively small investment in parallel computers. So you can reduce the operational cost by 2%. It's a huge saving for things like airlines and so on. And I think future uses of parallel computing technology will come from you guys. You will think up newer ways of using this humongous power. And I talked about petaflop. A petaflop is happening right now. What's happening in 3 years from now? 2011, just yesterday I got this email. Some of you might have heard that we, Illinois, won a competition from NSF for building the next generation supercomputer. This is NSF's best computer for year 2010. It will actually be working in end of 2010, but made available to the users in 2011. So friendly user period begins 3 years from yesterday, or day before yesterday. This machine, by NSF's requirement, will be peak performance of a petaflop. And peak sustained performance of a petaflop. Sustained is a complicated term. It's not the performance on the LINPACK benchmark, but on a mix of benchmarks. Okay, and so it's very ill-defined term in some ways, but you typically you find that the peak performance is such and such, and again we'll come back to this concept later on in the course, but typical machines perform at the speed of maybe 10, typical applications perform at about 10% of that peak efficiency, right? And this is because of a variety of reasons, need to communicate across processors, need to access memory, and so on, and all of those we'll deal with as we go through. So, NSF wanted a sustained performance of a petaflop, so it's obvious that our machine would have a peak performance of several petaflops. Unfortunately, I can't tell you how many. That's supposedly IBM doesn't want. It's an IBM machine, but it's not a Blue Gene, and it's something that IBM and I guess this is an NCSA. It will be at NCSA. I don't think we want that public yet. Also, so I can't tell you what the number in terms of peak petaflops will be, but you can imagine that it will be somewhere between 5 and 15 at least, right? That much anyone can guess. People are guessing that kind of number. And so that machine will be here in 3 years. Some of you probably wouldn't have graduated. Hopefully, all of you think you're graduated by then, so we'll see. So I wanted to actually get into a really broad brush. So that's what is happening with machines. How do you go about programming those machines? That's our concern in this course, right? So I wanted to do a broad brush introduction, which I think we'll do start today, but do mostly next time. Well, let's see how far I can go in 3-4 minutes, and then we'll decide. We'll look at, there are all kinds of machines people have built. Some of these are very strange, but if you look at the machines that people use, including all of them in top 500, and probably several more, they fall, and what people have on their desktop. All that the people use in the top 500 are probably in the last two bullets. These are so-called distributed memory machines, and I'll explain what that means. But on the desktop, what you see is something called bus-based shared memory machines. And then there was something else that was very popular with academics and some industry, which is scalable shared memory machines. And so those are the four categories. The fourth one is actually a combination of the fact that your nodes, single nodes, PCs today are multi-core PCs, actually multiple multi-core chips put together on a single node, right? And so that's why they're called symmetric multiprocessors, symmetric for whatever reasons, but they're multiprocessor nodes and you're putting many of them together. This is the very common. So Abe at NCSA, Abe for Abraham Lincoln, that's a machine with 9,600 cores, but it's actually 1,200 nodes. Each node has each node has 8 cores, basically two quad core chips. So that's how it becomes almost 10,000 processors. It has only 1,200 nodes. And so that's the example of a bus-based SMP nodes and clusters built using them, which is becoming commonplace now, which will be the machine at the high end that you all will focus on, unless you are working on a single desktop or you're working on a cluster. But even on a cluster, you'll be doing that. You won't be doing plain distributed memory machines anymore, because even the processors that you buy will always be multi-core from now on. So very briefly, what's a bus-based machine? You have a single processor, which is typically has a processor and memory, and you can attach other devices to it, right? That's kind of a rough architecture. We're not going to get into the detailed architecture in this course. That's probably not appropriate for this course. We're going to know architecture only to the extent that we need to know to do the programming well, okay? And so a simple architecture looks like this: processor, memory, and there are other devices on this wire. This wire is called a bus because it's shared actually between multiple devices. So who puts the data on it has to be arbitrated. That's what a bus is as opposed to just a connecting wire. And so one can do the following. One can actually put other processors and other processors and get a parallel machine that way. They all share this bus. And memory, well, you can actually put other memory modules there as well, so that memory modules themselves, as we learn in the next class, next couple of classes somewhere, memory is pretty slow compared with the processor, okay? And so putting multiple memory units allows the slow memory to still kind of So the bus is not just waiting for the memory, you can utilize it for other memories to move their data to the processors and vice versa. This is a simple bus-based machine. You can so of course you cannot keep adding more and more processors. At some point, the bandwidth of the bus, the number of bytes it can transfer per unit, becomes a bottleneck. And so so what you do is you have distributed memory machines. Well, okay, these two pictures are exchanged. I need to change that. So this is actually a shared memory machine, scalable shared memory machine. What happens here is that you have processor and its memory with its own bus, and you connect that to the interconnection network. Okay, or you, sorry, no, this is correct, sorry, the label is correct. You have processors, you have memories, but instead of a bus in between, which could become a bottleneck, you have a more complicated telephone-like network. I can dial the number of any particular memory and get it from there. And so the network has all kinds of links in it, so it allows multiple transfers to happen simultaneously rather than a bus, which allows only one transfer to happen at a time. This is this is the so-called scalable shared memory machine. It's complicated by the fact that there is something called cache, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, but we'll get to that in a more detailed discussion some other time. And the pure distributed memory machine is where every processor has its own memory, and the only way it communicates with other processors is through exchanging something called messages, exchanging data specifically with each other through the interconnection network. Now, when you and then the next question is, okay, those are the kinds of machines. What kind of parallel programming models exist? And we'll start talking about them next time. But please do remember to get your accounts as soon as you can, because we'll be starting your MP soon.